Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. It's the new year and we have the same old takes. Just kidding. Joining us from Los Angeles, where it's very early in the morning on Monday morning as we record this, is Kevin Arnovitz. Hi, Kevin. Hope you're doing well.
I'm well.
Joining us from Oklahoma City, where he's covering the hottest team in the NBA, the Oklahoma City Thunder, is Royce Young. Royce, how about those Thunder?
How about those Thunder? Those Thunderers? Thunder guys? That's the reason I hate the singular.
Thunder
names.
Men.
Thunder Sounds men. Terrible.
We've had some quite an interesting 3 or 4 days of developments in the NBA. It was just like a rush of lots of stuff happening. I really didn't even know where to start, but we got two, you know, big men on the trade market that both are complicated and things are happening with both. And that would be Kevin Love and Andre Drummond. Now, Kevin Love had an interesting weekend. According to The Athletic, he got into a screaming match with Kobe Altman, the general manager, on a practice, and basically is tired of being there. And during the game, you had his close friend Channing Frye tweeting during the game, the Cavs game Saturday night, about while they were playing the Thunder, tweeting about what was frustrating Kevin. He had Kevin using social media after the game to deny it. Meanwhile, I can tell you that, you know, he absolutely, totally wants to get out of there. It's driven him various levels of crazy to be there this season. But there's not that much traction in the trade as far as I can tell. Now, we always have a little bit of an information lag in this business. I can be saying, that there's not much traction, and literally at this moment there could be something happening. But my feel from talking to people is just not much traction. So that is a bit of a mess, to say the least. Kevin, what do you think Kevin Love's value is right now in the NBA trade marketplace?
Here's the problem. The guy's owed $91 million beyond this year, over 3 years. In a league where teams desperately want cap space in 2021. So, I mean, I think, and this isn't a commentary, he's actually played quite well, but the problem he's going to have is it has negative value. Who is going to absorb 3 years and $91 million, take themselves out of a really prolific 2021 free agency season? And I just, in a league, by the way, where, you know, fours are now looking like threes, and there's a limited demand for big men of any kind.
I think there's teams that would do it. In fact, one of the things that's been remarkable to me as I've talked to some people around the league about Kevin in the last 48 to 72 hours is there's a lot of people who really, really value him and really like him. But the problem is, as you said, because of the contract, it's a difficult thing to come up with a trade for, because the Cavs are viewing trading an all-star level player. The other teams are saying, yeah, he's a good player, but we're taking on this money, and we know that at the end of the contract he might not necessarily be performing at that level, and they think that they're bailing the Cavs out. I think there's a demand for him. I just don't know if there's a match in, you know, what his actual, that's why I asked Kevin, like, you know, what would you trade for Kevin Love right now? I mean, it's hard to come up with. Not only do you have to find a team, but you got to find a trade where the Cavs can be satisfied, and I think that's going to be hard.
Right, and I mean, this is kind of a similar situation that you see to a lot of well-paid star players, that a lot of teams would love to have that player. I mean, I think of, it's not directly comparable to someone like Chris Paul. You know, a lot of people talk about how untradeable Chris Paul is right now. Well, Chris Paul's playing great. He's a really good player. But the reason people can't trade for him or don't want to trade for him is because of the future contract. And so it's similar to Kevin Love, that he's still a very good player. He would help a team immensely if he stepped onto a roster and let's say he was their third best player. That team's going to be really good. He still is extremely capable as an NBA player. So it's not like a question of what can Kevin Love do for a team, but the contract is difficult, and that makes the parameters of a trade tough. You know, it's the thing to me, Brian, that is just so uncomfortable with these type of situations. You know, Kevin Love was given an extension by the Cavs. It was kind of like the Cavs were pulling what the Thunder did when Durant left. You know, they offered Russell Westbrook the extension. That was kind of their move to stabilize the franchise, give them a building block to start piecing things around on the roster. The Cavs did a similar type of move with Kevin Love. LeBron leaves. They hand Kevin Love this big extension to try to give them some sort of foothold as they chart a path into figuring out how to rebuild the roster. And, you know, Kevin Love signed that extension. He was like, I'm in. I want that money. That money sounds awesome. And I guess he was entrusting Kobe Altman and the Cavs front office to get that team back to where he wanted to be. It hasn't been that long ago since he signed it. And now it's to the point where he desperately wants out, like you said. So, you know, it's like this, the whole stabilizing the franchise move went completely wrong. That did not happen. And it's like I don't want to call it the inverse of the player empowerment, but this is not the way that player empowerment is supposed to work, right? This is not the way that players are supposed to be requesting their trades.
Paul
George thing.
Yeah, as far as I know, Kevin approached the Cavs about doing that extension. He was a year away from free agency, where he would have been part of a strong free agent class, but certainly would have probably been able to land a max or near it. But as far as I know, he approached the Cavs after LeBron left and said, hey, would you be willing to extend my contract? Now, his side of the story would be when the Cavs did that deal, he thought they were going to try to continue playoffs and that they had retained Ty Lue as coach, that they had re-signed his friend Channing Frye. And then everything went sideways very quickly. You had Ty Lue saying, I don't want to be a part of this. He got out of there. J.R. Smith was upset at the way things were going. I mean, he did not act in an appropriate manner. I'm not absolving J.R., but J.R. was like, this is not what I signed up for. Channing Frye, very clearly, is not what he signed up for. He retired. Kevin's sort of the last guy left. But, you know, in fairness, he had to know when he signed that contract that, you know, it was probably going to be more difficult than it had been. Kevin, let me ask you something real quick, Kevin. When you evaluate Kevin Love and whether you would like to have him on your team, I know he's been very outspoken, received a lot of support about his willingness to be outspoken about his mental health challenges. Does that concern you that you have a guy who has admitted that this has been a problem for him? Does that weigh on you when you consider about trading for him?
No. I mean, in terms of classification, okay, this is a problem because, he suffers from mental health issues or not necessarily. I mean, I think what you gauge is there going to be atmosphere? The fact that, take the demonstration the other day, right? He's on the floor, throwing his hands up in disgust because, the ball didn't get to him at the top of the floor. I suspect Kevin Love has every reason to be disgusted. If you're a veteran who likes to play a certain selfless style, and you've got ball-dominant young guards who really suffer from myopia that is common among young guards with talent. So I don't think it's a problem insofar as, hey, he has been an outspoken, vocal advocate for mental health care. I think the problem might be that, hey, there are times when Kevin Love's expectations may or may not disrupt locker room chemistry. I always like to evaluate behavior rather than innate condition, right? And I think that's sort of my careful way of characterizing it. I mean, I think if you we've learned this about sports, Brian. Like, if you bring the right collection of skills, people will accept just about anything. Right, it is how your behavior manifests itself, and this sounds like a criticism of Kevin, which is why I'm speaking so deliberately. Because I'm actually a big fan. I'm like Royce. I'm a big fan of his game. I'm a big fan of his skill set. I'm a big fan of the guy. My issue is, interestingly enough, and I've been such an advocate for player self-determination and player empowerment, but there does come a point, and I would throw Andre Iguodala in this category, where just as a working person, I just want to say, like, look, man, if you don't like the situation, sign a 1-1. Have an escape valve. You're a 31-year-old big man in a league where big men are less valuable. If you want flexibility, sign a 2-1 or have a player out, okay? If you want the $20 million, like, you're going to be subject to the vagaries of a team in a small market that may or may not rebuild or may not have an experienced GM that you like, that may or may not be in a climate that you do or do not like. Like, that's sort of, I'm getting a little tired of it. I totally grant every player to get as much as they want, but it's the nature of secure contracts is you get the guarantee and you also forfeit your free agency. Like, that is
that's what the money's for.
That's what the money is for, as Don Draper famously said.
Yeah. Well, I would just say that when you look at Kevin Love and you look about trading for him, the first thing you got to consider is that contract. The second thing you got to consider is his injury history, because shortly after signing it, he had a toe or a foot injury last year that pretty much wiped out 75% of that season, and he's had a number of other injuries over his career, various surgeries. I think since he's come to Cleveland, he's had four different surgeries. And then that was concerning more, right? Yeah. I mean, these are all factors. Now, in regards to, I hear people keep talking about 2021, you know, wanting to save cap space for that. One thing, when I talk to executives, when I talk about stuff like that, they say, when you look at Love, and I think we can bring Drummond into this conversation too, you have to evaluate whether or not you can get somebody of that quality in the free agent class. Just because you have cap space doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to use it on signing a player. And so the question becomes is, you know, can you, you know, okay, let's say you don't do a trade for Kevin Love. Can you sign a player as high of a quality as Kevin Love with your 27 or 28 million in cap space that you might have? In a lot of cases, the answer is no. And that's why when I look at the market for Kevin, I look at teams that may not be able to have cap space one way or another, that this would be their best option. So a lot of people jump to the Portland Trailblazers because they felt I don't feel that there's a match there for him. I think there's
because the guy grew up there. Meanwhile, what are they paying in tax this year? $19 million? And how do you make the salaries work?
Payroll in the league.
Right. Like, yeah, I just don't see it.
I think of a team like Charlotte, for example. I think of a team. This is a little bit kind of like
Washington for him too, Brian. If you're
you know, my only thing with Washington is I wonder if their trajectory matches Love. You know, this year they're not doing anything, and you know, next year we don't really. You know, I'm still not 100% convinced that. They're absolutely not going to trade Bradley Beal. They can't trade him this year, but I'm not convinced that they have decided that they're going to keep him long term. So,
you've just brought up the weird contradiction of the league. By definition, who are the teams that generally can't recruit a top line free agency or then left holding their cap space? They tend to be small market teams, and most small market teams, if they're not contending, tend to be rebuilding. Which is, okay, so why are we going to bring in a guy who at age 34 is going to be making $30 million and very likely an injury risk, right? So, like, okay, Charlotte is interesting, but are they interesting? I mean, they clearly are trying to turn the page and rebuild around their young players, and they've got a couple of good ones. Are you going, if I'm Charlotte, I'm like, we've been down this road before, right? Like, trying to populate our rosters with veterans to kind of sneak into the sixth spot, and what happens? You end up holding a bunch of 30-some-odd-year-old guys with terrible contracts, and you're going nowhere fast. And, by the way, you're delaying.
Well, what about a team like Memphis who, yeah, they have a guy who plays his position.
Yeah, and Jaren Jackson, I mean, who's fantastic. But
a team like Memphis or a team like Atlanta, again, they have a guy who plays his position. You're probably not going to be able to get that type of player anyway. So that's the.
No, but that type of player is Jaren Jackson in 3 years. Do you hear what I'm saying? Like they're not going to get that kind of player. But
well, that's the debate, though, Kevin, because Memphis, like a team like Memphis is on, and I'm not saying for Kevin Love, but a team like Memphis is on the bubble for making the playoffs. You know, they're all of a sudden having a good season. They have these giant expiring contracts and trade assets.
There's nothing about Zach Kleiman's operational manner right now that suggests to me that he is interested in devoting 30% of his cap space 3 years from now to a 34-year-old Kevin Love.
Right. I'm not saying Kevin Love from Memphis, but I'm just saying, like, when you think of teams in that zone, that's the kind of team that I think you look at for Kevin Love.
This trade would never happen, but it's kind of an interesting one for me to think about. What if Danilo Gallinari and Andre Robertson for Kevin Love? Two expiring deals. And Kevin Love goes to the Thunder, the overachieving Thunder.
Well, again, the Thunder are probably not going to be able to sign free agents. So talking to them about 2021 cap space is, you know, it's not
right. They're not in that conversation, and it also kind of disrupts what their future plan is, which is to eventually bottom out and begin a complete rebuild. But it puts Kevin Love kind of on. You know, you've got Chris Paul for multiple more seasons. You put Kevin Love next to him. You can, I don't know. It's not a likely deal by any means.
Well, I think one team that I think would be somewhat interesting would be Phoenix. They have the Tyler Johnson contract that they can use as the big piece of a trade. Why shouldn't the Cavs get another guard who's got a giant contract who doesn't play much? They have a bunch of those. Mm-hmm. Obviously there would have to be some other type of piece of compensation in there. But, you know, Phoenix is a team that, you know, may fancy itself as being able to be a free agent destination, but would really love to advance forward and get into the playoffs. You add a player of that ability to spread the floor there, he would be a very interesting piece for a team like Phoenix. That's an interesting team to me. I don't know how the deal would work out. I don't know how, you know, what the Cavs would ask for there. But that, you know, they have Booker, they have Kelly Oubre, who's having a really good season, should be a most improved candidate in my mind. They had signed Frank Kaminsky to kind of do what they hoped a poor man's Kevin Love, and now Kaminsky is hurt and out. So, you know, I don't know. That'd be an interesting team as an example. To switch to Drummond, Drummond is it's kind of a similar idea. He has a player option for next season, and that as far as I know, that's an interesting piece of conversation within trade talks with Detroit, because Detroit's owner Tom Gores gave an interview. Tom Gores is LA based. The Pistons came out to LA. Tom Gores gave an interview to some of their beat writers, and he basically said in that interview, "We may need to make changes. We may have to admit that this group isn't getting us where we want. And we may need to make changes." And that was a significant thing for Tom Gores to say on the record, because he has been the type of owner who has pressed for competing no matter what, even if you're looking at being the eighth seed. He hired Dwayne Casey to get his team to the playoffs. The moves that they've made have been doing that. So for him to say that, and then it was not a surprise at all to me, within 24 hours of giving that interview, Woj had the story of Drummond being them being in talks with Drummond with the Hawks. The thing about Drummond is he has this player option for next season, which I think is $28 million. If you're going to trade for Andre Drummond, I would think you would either A, want him to pick up that option, or B, you'd want to negotiate an extension with him, or at least have the idea there's going to be an extension, because if you're a team like the Hawks, I mean, what do you care about an Andre Drummond rental? You know, you'd be committing to him. You'd say we want him to be our center going forward. And this is really, you know, really the challenge of trading a guy like Drummond with that contract situation. And, you know, he has had contract extension talks with the Pistons, and they did not advance. As far as I know, again, I could be behind. They could be having them right now. But the Pistons had a difficult time committing to him long term at his number. I would think another team would maybe have that same problem too. But, you know, Drummond may also realize that this summer the ground isn't necessarily fertile for, you know, 7-footers who don't shoot 3-pointers. In fact, I don't think Drummond's ever made a 3-pointer in his career. He's a great rebounder. He's one of the best rebounders in the league. He can at times be a really good defensive player when he's engaged. That's another situation where, boy, does it have to be the right team? And it has to be a team that says, this is a player that we, this is probably better than the player that we can get in free agency. And that's why you look at a team like Atlanta and you say, boy, this would be their free agent move for the summer, because they have all these expiring contracts. They have Evan Turner and Chandler Parsons. And like, is this our free agent move? Where you wouldn't be worrying about cap space. And so that, it makes it hard to find a trade partner, Kevin, when you look at a player like that, regardless of his fit, just in terms of team planning. I think Love presents the same challenge.
Yeah, and again, you need this sort of Chris Paul, I'll opt in to my deal before the trade guarantee, right? And Detroit is under the gun now, because the truth of the matter is everybody knows that, I mean, if he gets to summer, I mean, maybe he opts in, I don't know. You said, you're right, there's not a lot of cap space out there, and so there's not a lot of choice, but we've also seen that teams can always find the space if they need it. I mean, we've seen this over and over again. But, I mean, Detroit's now under the gun, right? I mean, if he declines that option and decides he doesn't want to be in Detroit anymore, they get nothing. The Atlanta rumor was really interesting to me, Brian, because it has all the sounds of an owner who wants to do something. You know, Atlanta, for all we can talk about, is they didn't have expectations. There's a long runway. This is the process, too. They've even hired a Brett Brown assistant. Things have gotten a little bit grisly there, right? Like, they were 7-27. There's discontent. They're consistently uncompetitive.
There's discontent from Trae Young.
Right. But I'm saying there's atmosphere, right? For a team, say what we will about Philadelphia, there was never, by and large, there was an understanding that as much as you might want to critique the strategy, no one ever said, boy, this is going poorly, for the most part, internally. So I thought, okay, that's the sign. Because Travis Schlenk has been very patient. I mean, he is clearly exercising on patience. He does not feel the need to go do anything splashy. We are going to build from within. We are acquiring assets. We are absorbing bad contracts. And I think this has all the looks of an owner who wants something done. We've got to get better. I'm with you in the sense that I started thinking about it. It's like, okay, the Hawks have space. They're one of the few teams with space in the near future. Drummond's only 26. I had this moment with a bunch of us on, I think it was on Set at the Jump, where, Helen's Drummond. We all look at our phones. It's got to be 29, 20, 30, 30, 28. It's like, oh God, only 26. So if you're the Hawks, do you say, all right, to Brian's point, there are worse things to happen in the next few years than a pick and roll combination of Trae Young and Andre Drummond? We know that John Collins is not a five, as much as we'd love for him to be a five, right? Like, he's just not. And Drummond has become a really decent pick and roll defender, and he can rebound the hell out of a ball. This is a place where we could desperately need help. And it just kind of stabilizes us for the next few years. And who's to say, it doesn't always have to be the Sam Presti plan where the guys all have to be the same age and on the same track, like, and there's this window and everybody's aligned chronologically. Like, this is okay. We can do this. And as you said, it's not like they're going to attract a big-time free agent anytime soon anyway.
And now, I also think there's a factor of you going to Trae Young and saying, hey, we're trying to make the team better, because I do think Trae has been frustrated.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I've gone from being, I don't understand this, to, okay, there are worse ways to use your theoretical, your cap space that is real, even though it's kind of only theoretical in conversations, because, like, why not? I don't love Drummond as a player. That's sort of a different conversation. It's just because, I, as you said, like, I'm just not a big fan of devoting a significant amount of cap space to, you know, bigs who aren't, like, elite rim protectors and don't have any range. Like, it's just not my thing. So, I mean, that's sort of what Atlanta's trying to do schematically. I'm not crazy about it, but I'm still to kind of talk myself into the idea that, okay, this is not completely idiotic.
It's one thing. It's interesting to point out that he has the same agent, Jeff Schwartz, as Kevin Love. And one of the things I think the agents, especially Jeff, who I think is now the highest grossing agent in the league in terms of players under contract. He's probably the biggest power broker in the league right now. He has looked to get some of his guys extensions because he knows that the market is going to be a little dry this summer. And so, you know, he got Kevin Love an extension. He engineered that extension. He's tried to get Andre Drummond extended. And I think one of the things that he has kind of made clear to the Pistons is, hey, if you're not going to extend our guy, he wants to be there, but if you're not going to give him an extension, maybe trade him somewhere where he can get an extension or at least get a new contract, because with the dearth of cap space this summer, bird rights are pretty important. And so I think that's also part of it, Royce.
There's another issue here, and I'm hearing more and more front offices talk in this sense. And it used to be something that was the province of a few of the analytic-minded front offices, and it's becoming more and more common. And we saw it with Clint Capella's negotiation a couple of years ago. There are fewer and fewer teams who believe that you should ever invest heavily in big man, unless they are a franchise-changing Rudy Gobert, Defensive Player of the Year, or just a Joel, Karl Anthony Towns, which is uncommon offensive skill or combination of thereof in Embiid's case. And, you know, Houston would not move off that number, right? Like, we're not going to pay this guy more than $15 million a year on average, like, or much more. And I think that's becoming more and more common. In the words of one executive I talked to a couple of years ago, who was sort of on the cutting edge of this, centers are a mercenary position. You can go out and get a Brook Lopez when you want one, as the Bucks did a couple of years ago. Now they had to pay him. But there's always a short-term solution at a position where, hell, in a conference semifinals, you might not have a traditional big man on the floor half the time. And I think that's one of the things, aside from just contracts and everything else and who has cap space, where Love and Drummond are coming into difficulty, because there's just not an insatiable demand like there used to be for big men. People don't want to invest their money that way in a cap system. And I think that's what we're running into.
Jackie McMullen and Kirk Goldsberry just put out a piece within the last three, four days about the vanishing, not just the post player, but the actual post play. Rick Carlisle has recently talked about this, how it's just the math doesn't work on it. Unless you're talking about, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar level, throw it in there and that guy scores at that kind of efficiency, the math doesn't work on it. Because he was getting criticized or questioned, I guess, about not posting up Kristaps Porzingis. And he's like, the play doesn't make sense.
And he's right.
So,
but at the same time, you know, specifically to the Hawks, like, their primary issue is on the defensive end. And so, you know, one of the quick solutions to bad defense is a good big man. And so, like you said, Kevin, I'm with you. It is kind of a mercenary position, but when you take that approach, you end up with Alex Len playing 30 minutes for you or something.
But here's the thing. The Hawks are 30th in offensive rating. They're 30th.
Right. Yeah.
They're 30th in offense.
And
they're terrible.
You know, the primary reason for that is because I think their offensive rating is like 88 when Trae Young is sitting. I mean, it's comically bad when Trae Young sits down. They have no secondary ball handlers on the team. One thing I would say, Brian, just because I looked it up, Andre Drummond has 10 career 3-point makes. Thank you very much. He had a breakout year last year with 5.
Apologies.
Big year last year. I think though, for a team like the Hawks, you know, in this Drummond conversation, you know, there are some parallels, you know, to what Oklahoma City did when they traded for Kendrick Perkins. You know, there was some conversation that maybe the Hawks would, if the Thunder were selling on Steven Adams, that would be a good fit. He could kind of change their locker room mentality, give them that kind of toughness. Because there's no question about it, Trae Young is frustrated. The Hawks are frustrated. It's not like they set an expectation for themselves this year, but they did feel like that they were going to take a quality leap forward, and that they have gone the other way. They have taken.
Well, I thought they were going to be a bubble playoff team. How about that?
Absolutely. I picked them eighth. I had them eighth in the East, Brian. I mean, I thought they had built momentum at the end of last season, and I think what's frustrating Trey specifically and just the Hawks is that while his rise has not coincided with the Hawks. I mean, Trae Young has exploded. His development is clear as an offensive player,
leading the East guards.
Yeah, and in fourth in scoring. And, I mean, the guy has blossomed quicker than they could have ever hoped for.
Yeah, he's going to be an all-star. He's going to be an all-star starter this year.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, but here's my question for the Hawks in trading for somebody like Andre Drummond. Are you better off doing that, even if you get him to opt into the $28 million? Or would you rather just sit there and hold your cap space and make an offer to Montrezl Harrell? Because
and by the way, let me throw a third option in, Brian and Royce. Like, you could have Dwayne Dedman at 13-3, 13-3 in a non-guarantee in 21-22. Well, a guy, by the way, who Atlanta will tell you they really miss in the locker room, who was stabilized their team last year. I mean, look, I don't think Dwayne Dedman is a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but he's enough. Or do you want to face uncertainty with what Drummond wants and how much you're going to have to pay him when, by the way, he's going to be 28, 29, 30, and 31 and probably less effective, or roll the dice with $91 million to Kevin Love? If I'm looking for a big man, if I'm Boston or whoever else, it's like, go with Dedman. Like that's the thing. You're devoting, 11% of your cap space to a guy who can shoot a little bit. I mean, I know he's been unhappy in Sacramento, but, you know, Hawks thought he was teammate of the year.
Well, when it comes to the Celtics, by the way, because the Celtics get thrown around in a lot of things. And actually, the Celtics are in a very, very interesting position right now. I think both the Celtics and the Nuggets, because...
The Heat, I'd throw in that category too, I think.
I agree. You know, the Heat are, for sure... If you are... The Celtics team that they got to worry about is the Sixers. The Celtics kind of believe that they've got a fighting chance against the Bucks. Would they win that series? How many times out of 10? 4, 3? I don't know. They don't feel as good about the 76ers because they don't have a good matchup for Embiid. But if they're in the 2 seed or the 3 seed, but specifically the 2, and the Sixers keep messing around and end up on the other side of the bracket, they could end up being in a position where they don't have to play both Milwaukee and Philly. And if that's the case, that, in my mind, really exponentially increases their chances of finding a way to back themselves into the finals this year. And to me, that's more impetus to maybe look to improve their team. Having said that, they are really limited in what they can do with trade because they do not intend to trade any of their frontline stars. So I think if you look at the pieces on their roster, they can get to somewhere in the neighborhood of a $13 to $15 million player without having to move Brown, Tatum, Smart, Kemba, or Hayward. They can, if they can sort of cobble together some pieces to get to $13 to $15 million. So I hear people talking about the Celtics. Oh, yeah, you know, the Celtics for Kevin Love, the Celtics for so-and-so. I would be looking more along the Dedman line if they're going to do a deal.
Exactly.
That type of player. But I think the number 2 seed, and we're sitting here in January, it's hard to say, but the number 2 seed in each conference, going to be interesting. Could be a very desirable place to be because the Clippers and 76ers are not demonstrate, and I talked about this last week, and Jackie McMullen kind of slapped me down and said the difference between second place and fifth place right now is 2 games or 3 games or game and a half.
It's actually 1 game now as of this morning.
Right. But it would be interesting if Philly and the Clippers both sort of go along at this level and don't step forward into that top two, being on the opposite end of them in the bracket could be pretty advantageous. If you're the Denver Nuggets and you could potentially have a bracket where you don't have to play both LA teams, or if you're the Boston Celtics or Miami Heat, but specifically Boston to me, and you could end up on the opposite side as the 76ers, in my mind, you increase your chances dramatically. And speaking of that, you know, on Christmas Day, Philly had a great win against the Bucks, and the Clippers had a high quality victory against the Lakers. I know we're going to pick out, you know, 10 days here in the middle of the season. That's not, you know, be too focused on, but it has not gone well for those teams since the win. Philly hasn't won a game since Christmas, and their defense has been, which I thought they were going to be one of the best defensive teams, if not the best defensive team in the league, one of the best defensive teams we've seen in the last decade with the way they were built. That has not been the case. Brett Brown has just repeatedly been frustrated about how they've struggled defensively. Since Christmas Day, they're 18th in defense. Since Christmas Day, the Los Angeles Clippers are 26th in defense. And coming off a weekend where they gave up 140 points to the Grizzlies, who are playing great offense right now. The Grizzlies, by the way, over the last month are the number two offensive team in the league. But 140 points to Memphis and 132 to the Knicks. Something, nothing, or everything to take a jump conceit, Kevin. Are you worried about – should we be spending time worrying about Philly and the Clippers right now? Or is this just a January thing where when it matters, they'll be fine?
With Philly, I'm a little concerned because I just think they're fundamental. Say what you will about the defense struggling the last week or two, that's fine. But they have fundamental spacing issues. And it's just so obviously clear. And a team that can ill afford them. Because it's not just an issue of, oh, we don't have shooters, right? When guys are in the paint, Ben Simmons can't get there, right? Like, it's just clogged. He requires space. Horford has become this sort of odd, you're not getting the full Horford experience, you know, if you can't play him at the pinch post and you can't let him do that. You can run these wonderful kind of offensive variations through him at that position. We can debate, well,
he's become a floor spacer.
Yeah. And like, okay, that's fine. I mean, he's not a terrible floor spacer, but it's not why you pay the guy. And it's not maximizing his attributes. And I kind of feel for Brett Brown. Like, he's been furnished with a little bit of an odd collection of misfit toys. And by the way, yet each individual player, you say, that's a nice player. We all loved Josh Richardson last year, right? He was one of the feel-good stories in the league. A guy who just brings it every night. And, yeah, not a great shooter, but does so many things. Like, each guy individually, you can say, that's a great player. But they're just, I worry about the spacing. And, you know, J.J. Redick is not walking through that door. Marco Bellinelli is not walking through that door. And so let's see what they do in the buyout market. But right now, I'm really concerned with that. You know, the Clippers are interesting. I spent a lot of time around them. And the refrain is the same. Like, look, how many games have we actually had the full squad out there? And the answer, you know, in their defense is very rarely. And so with them, I am inclined to say, look, let's give it some time. I mean, I think we know, you know, I was talking with someone yesterday who was like, yeah, the Christmas Day game is the template for what they're going to do when it matters. This is the league, Brian, this is the league's new flip the switch team, right? It used to be the LeBron Cavs, or before him, the Heat. The Clippers are the ultimate flip the switch team because of just the regimen that Leonard has, where he's sitting every third or fourth game. George is still working through some issues. Beverly's not healthy. I don't worry about them as much. Now, I worry in the sense that this is a really competitive West. But Philly, I feel like, has real schematic deficiencies. The Clippers, it's sort of like, let's check back in late February, early March, and see where they are in terms of on the nights where they have their full squad.
Yeah, Clippers, nothing. Sixers, something. I think that's pretty straightforward. And like Kevin said, when it comes specifically to the Clippers, you know, when you're playing with only your full roster, the one that you know, universally most people agreed that you had the best summer of anybody, only three out of four games. I don't know what it exactly is, but Kawhi Leonard and Paul George have played together, what, probably 15 times this year? I don't know what it is, 18 times?
I doubt it's that high. I don't think it's that high.
And whatever it is, their record is exceptional in the two games, in the games that they do play together. So, you know, I, when it comes to postseason or when the games matter, And the Clippers are putting their best eight out on the floor, not concerned. And look, are they going to win the NBA title? I don't know. It's really competitive. There's some really good teams out there. But if we're talking about worrisome trends, I'm not really worried at all about the Clippers. I do think that on top of even what Kevin said about the Sixers, you know, sometimes we overstate chemistry. Sometimes we wonder too deeply about it. A lot of times we don't even know enough details about what's really going on within a team. But, you know, there's enough little things going on around the Sixers that makes you wonder that on top of the kind of the technical issues that they do have, like spacing, and I think that they have some questions about their bench too, But, you know, do they play well together? And Horford does feel like he was kind of shoehorned in there and that they're not maximizing his skill set. And, you know, on top of Ben Simmons' deficiencies as a shooter and the frustrations I think that comes within that and what the Sixers are trying to encourage him to do and what he's reluctant to do. I mean, there's just kind of messy elements there that make you raise an eyebrow and make you sometimes wonder, look, really, really good contending teams don't lose five in a row. That doesn't happen very often. That shouldn't happen very often unless you got LeBron James on the team and he just kind of quits caring for a month. And then you know that he's going to come around.
Hey, just wanted to make a quick little comment here. We appreciate all the feedback that you guys have for Hoop Collective. You're subscribing, rating, and reviewing, of course, right? That's what I always encourage you to do. Thank you very much. Our producers are reading every word of those reviews, and they're always trying to figure out the ways they can make the show better. And along those lines, I really think that you should, if you're not already listening to it, which you should be, you should make some time to check out the Woj Pod with Adrian Wojnarowski, who's our esteemed NBA insider. He has great NBA guests on. He's had Trae Young and Sam Presti on just within the last month or so. And this week coming up, he's got a conversation coming with Patty Mills of the San Antonio Spurs, who is not only having one of the best seasons of his career, but also leading an awareness campaign to raise money and support for the bushfires that are ravaging Australia, his native Australia right now. So if you love basketball or just the NBA in general, you can always listen to the Woj Pod right here or wherever you get your podcasts. Kyrie Irving gave his first interview in almost 2 months over the weekend, where he explained that his shoulder impingement injury is actually bursitis and that he had a cortisone shot on Christmas Eve. And he frankly brought up the case that if the cortisone shot doesn't work, which they won't know for a little bit yet, he's probably going to need to have season-ending shoulder surgery. This brought up a wave of reaction because the Nets had been so silent about his absence. There were times where, while they stopped short of putting a timetable on it, there was never this vibe at all that this injury was this severe. They even kind of rolled it out in a way in calling him day-to-day that made it seem like he might be gone for a week or two, and it just kept extending. Kenny Atkinson came out and said that he's been gone longer than I thought he was going to be gone, and then all of a sudden you hear it's a potential season-ending injury. Then you have people saying he also said he was slower to get back because he is trying not to take anti-inflammatories, and that got some reaction. And I think it's important, and this is a very interesting scenario in this era of the NBA, because we talk a lot about player empowerment when it comes to what teams they're on, but there's also a lot of player empowerment when it comes to health. And when you look at Kyrie Irving's history, he has had a couple of things go poorly when it comes to his injuries. He tried to play through a knee injury in Cleveland in 2014, I guess 2015, the first year LeBron was back. You know, he kept seeing specialists and he kept playing through the injury, and then he ended up breaking his kneecap. Now, people in Cleveland don't believe that one had to do with the other, but I don't know how a guy can have a sore. He basically played on a sore foot, which led to a sore knee, which led to a broken kneecap. I'm not an orthopedist, but I refuse to believe that one didn't have anything to do with the other. Then he had surgery and he had some hardware left in there that caused him problems, and then when the hardware was taken out, he suffered an infection that really caused him problems. So I can kind of understand with Kyrie Irving's history why he is very cautious about wanting to have another surgery. But it is kind of a fascinating scenario, Kevin, where this was an injury that, even if he had needed surgery immediately, wouldn't have been season-ending. But the way Kyrie has elected to go about it, he may have treated it into a season-ending injury. And this is a complicated one for sure. And more concern about, you know, Kyrie Irving long-term, because he continues to have these injuries. And if he's going to be super conservative like this, it's going to be hard to know what you're going to get from him going forward.
Yeah, and I have no idea how the Brooklyn front office, their level of dissatisfaction or satisfaction, but I do think you hit on something really interesting, and we saw it with Kawhi Leonard, which is, I think in the next generation, one of the great points of tension between player and NBA franchise will be the management of health, right? We see more and more, you know, guys take it, as you say, player empowerment has very much been, I'm going to go to my guy. I will keep the team abreast, but the sort of the flow of information is much more in the hands of the player. And, you know, and if we know anything about NBA general managers and presidents of basketball operations, is like information is their currency. That is the mother's milk of running a front office. And I do think, and again, I'm not suggesting that's what is specifically going on here, but I think this is such a fast, again, Leonard sort of, that is, think about how monumental that's been for the power balance of the league. And I do think, like, as medicine gets more advanced, as you have more choices and routes for rehabilitation or treatment, and as players retain the right to do whatever whatever they want, that I just think you're going to see more and more of this in the next 15 years. Now, so far as Kyrie, I'm at the point where this season's a wash for Brooklyn. I mean, I think Brooklyn has always been about, October 14th, 2020. And I do wonder to what extent is Kyrie, whether in or not within consultation of the Nets, is sort of going to look at this merely and, hey, this year was a wash anyway. We're kind of all waiting around for Kevin. But it's always so hard to talk about Brian, right? Like, we don't know what's going on with the body. Like, we can sit here and kind of talk about offensive schemes and whether this guy is useful in this context, but it's very, I always have,
yeah, I have no idea what's going on with his shoulder. Right? I just think it's very interesting the way he's elected to go about this.
Is there a player who's more enigmatic about his sort of management of persona, health, career, route, and anything than Kyrie at this point?
No. and that kind of leads me to where your mind naturally goes, Kevin. And look, no question that Kyrie Irving has an injury that he's dealing through, but you touched on it a little bit, that this was always sort of a gap year anyway for the Nets. It wasn't off to a great start anyway with Kyrie Irving. There was some fit concerns. There was some chirps from Kenny Atkinson about not running their stuff. I mean, there was kind of some discomfort there about his leadership in the locker room and disrupting the systematic scheme and culture and all the good things the Nets did last year. So, like, when it comes to, like, when you kind of package all of that together, you know, I even kind of wondered to just sort of openly, like, would it be better if the Nets just shut Kyrie Irving down and just said, like, hey, we're just going to wait for next year anyway. That's what we were planning to do all along. And just...
here's a paid sabbatical?
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, seriously, I just wondered if that almost just made a little more sense for him.
$70 million to two guys who didn't play all season.
Well, and then the other factor is, you know, if this is something serious, you know, Kevin Durant's injury was extremely serious. And, you know, we're all making the assumption that he's going to come back and he's going to be a great player. But an Achilles injury is no joke. So, you know, you've got this complete investment in these two guys with now kind of decorated injury histories. You know, and don't forget, by the way, Kevin Durant had another career-threatening injury back in 2014-15 where he had the Jones fracture in his foot. He had three surgeries on that thing. Now, that got put to bed for the most part, and everybody feels good about that. But when you look at these two players and the investment the Nets have made, you've got to be just a little bit nervous about what seemed to be a blockbuster summer feels a little more wobbly now than it did.
I'm going to take the Durant scenario out of it. I'm only going to focus on the Kyrie health scenario. Kyrie, ever since he was a rookie in the league, has been fragile. You know, there are just certain players who, you know, don't take
same at Duke, right, Brian? I mean, what did he play at Duke? Yes. 10 games, 11 games?
Yes. I mean, and that's the other thing. It's one thing if you can say, well, he's got a bad knee. You know, he's had three knee injuries. He's had facial injuries. He's had shoulder injuries. He's had hand injuries. He's had foot injuries. He's had knee injuries all over the board. He's had multiple concussions, or at least one concussion I'm sure of. Maybe he's not had more. But he's had several facial fractures, you know. And he's a guy who's – a big part of his game is predicated on going in and taking contact. And so I would just say that Kyrie clearly has been extremely conservative with this injury. You talk about what medication he does or doesn't want to take. We talk about how he's done some things to avoid surgery. Even, it sounds like he even was trying to put off taking cortisone because he's concerned about his long-term health. And I certainly understand that, again, especially with what he's gone through in the past. But if you have a player who is very prone to injury, who also intends going forward to be very conservative with the treatment or the management of injuries, you look at a long-term thing and you wonder how much you're going to get out of that player. And I don't fault anybody for it. I'm not saying Kyrie's taking the wrong thing. He's got to make the choices for his body. Certainly there are people who have taken too many anti-inflammatories and ended up with other health problems. I totally understand why he's saying that. And again, I was around him when he played through injuries and it led to disaster. So I get it. I'm just saying it's one of the things that the Nets have to consider going forward as to how it's going to be with Kyrie Irving and a guy that you just committed 4 years to. The last topic I want to talk about today was something that was brought up by Nate Jones, who is a lawyer and works for one of the leading agencies in the NBA. He works for Goodwin Sports. Nate Jones, he's a terrific Twitter follow. He's essentially an agent. I don't know if he would describe himself that way, but he works at an agency. But he's a really interesting follow. Doesn't necessarily talk about his players he represents. He works very closely with Damian Lillard. But anyway, he tweeted over the weekend, who's having the better season, Russell Westbrook or Chris Paul? And I thought, Royce, that was a fascinating question to ask, especially as the Thunder are just soaring. I think they're five or six games above 500 now. Yeah, Chris is having a really good year.
Best record since December 1st. 13-4 since December
1st. Is that right? Wow, that's a good number.
Mm-hmm. No, second best record. Sorry, the Bucks have the one more win. But
Who's having the better year, Chris Paul or Russell Westbrook?
I mean, it honestly is, in some ways, Brian, that question is distilled down to just your opinion of Chris Paul or Russell Westbrook. You know, I think because Chris Paul has been very Chris Paul. He's managed the game. The numbers are not jumping off the chart necessarily, but in terms of the things that matter, he is playing winning basketball, leading a roster, selfless kind of generalship of an offense. He's been at the heart of the Thunder's dynamic three-point guard lineup. Chris Paul's kind of what has made that function and work. And on the other side,
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is having a spectacular year, and Chris Paul is.
Yes, and I think a lot of that's because Chris Paul has really empowered him, and I think he's empowered Dennis Schroeder, who's potential sixth man of the year candidate.
Big time bounce back year for Schroeder.
Yeah, absolutely. So I, and that's kind of the MO for Chris Paul, right? Is that he makes teammates better. He makes people that he plays with better. It doesn't matter who you put next to him. It could be four other point guards, and Chris Paul's going to figure out a way to make it work because that's just his makeup as a player. Now, Russell Westbrook, the efficiency numbers kind of continue to dip around him. Still solid overall. He is shooting 23% from three. It was laughable to me, Brian, how a lot of people were like, you just wait. He's going to go to Houston. He's going to get more catch-and-shoot opportunities, and that three-point percentage is going to come up. And I laughed at that because I kept saying to myself, well, you know what three-point percentage still requires is shooting, and Russell Westbrook can't shoot, and so it's not going to come up.
real quick on Westbrook, and I talked about this when they did the trade, that I was concerned about the efficiency slippage. Now, everybody has their pet stat. I'm not saying that this is the be-all, end-all, but Russell Westbrook's PER, okay, player efficiency rating, created by John Hollinger, a catch-all stat that takes into efficiency matters. When he won the MVP in 2016-17, he led the league at 30.6. Anything over 30 is one of the best seasons, ranks as one of the best seasons you'll ever see. The next year, the second year after Durant left, 24.7. Terrific number, all-star level for sure. You see a PER over 20, you got a great player. But pretty significant drop-off, basically 31 to 25. Last season, 21.1. Still good, but you're now talking about a significant drop-off. This year, 18.3. The league average, the way the PER is set, the league average number is always 15. So if your PER is 15, you are essentially a replacement level player, from an efficiency standpoint at least.
Right.
He's headed towards 15. Now at 18.3. That's all I'm going to say about those numbers. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Royce. Go ahead.
Well, no, but I do think that that's important. I mean, look, that's the other conversation around Westbrook is, you know, Chris Paul is 4 years older, but it feels like one is declining. You know, there was always the wonder of when Chris Paul was going to start to look a little less like himself, and he's looking more like himself than he ever has. But also, I think that's a product of he's back into kind of playing a little bit more of a comfortable role of what he's best at. You know, the ball's in his hands far more often. He's not standing on the wing waiting for James Harden to maybe or maybe not pass it to him. And, you know, now Russell Westbrook has kind of been cast into that role. And look, Mike D'Antoni's trying to stagger them, trying to kind of find opportunities for them to do their thing. But that hasn't really necessarily been all that effective either.
Right now is 20.7. So,
well, see, so if we're talking about who's having the better year, and I think you could extrapolate this the other way too. If you're naming the All-Star team today, who's the All-Star, Russell Westbrook or Chris Paul? And I think that, you know, traditional stats are going to push you towards Westbrook, but I think impact pushes you towards Chris Paul. So look, it's a tough conversation, and Russell Westbrook is still a great player, but he has not changed. He is still the same guy that he was in Oklahoma City, and he's in a little bit more of a uncomfortable fit. I think that that's part of what he's sort of battling against with the Rockets. And if you look at his on-off court numbers, and it's pretty jarring how much different the Rockets are offensively when Russell is sitting. When he's off the floor, they have almost 120 net rating or offensive rating. When he's
because
on the floor,
they have like more efficient options. Because from an efficiency standpoint,
they can play their way. They can play their way. They can put the ball in Harden's hands. They can spread the floor. They can play their style. Westbrook is not a great fit. I think that you could even ask this question, Brian, and I think that this is going to eventually be coming. If the Rockets are in a intense playoff series and they're in a game 5, game 6, and the other team is scheming them the way that teams are going to scheme them, I think Mike D'Antoni's going to be sitting there going, am I going to have to bench Russell Westbrook? Because I think
basically,
that conversation
not
is going to be coming. That's the way the Warriors defended the Rockets on Christmas Day. Draymond Green was on Westbrook, quote-unquote on Westbrook, and just tried to bracket James Harden. And that's what they did. And I think teams are going to apply that sort of scheme in a postseason series.
I mean, I don't think it's close. You can take whatever metric. I mean, it's subjective, I guess. But I'm having trouble finding any place where, you know, Russell has been better than Chris. Russell Westbrook is actually on the way to having one of the most futile three-point shooting seasons in NBA history. Not one of the. Never before has a guy attempted more than 4.5 a game. He's got 4.8 and shot less than 26%. He's shooting 23.5. Jordan Poole's actually plays far less, so this season is also kind of on that route, but Russell is going to have the most futile 3-point shooting team, and that's not the only thing that matters in basketball. I know we fetishize shooting, so I don't want to be totally unfair, but I'm just looking up and down, and I don't mean to be tough on Russell Westbrook. I still love watching Russell Westbrook play basketball, but there's very little other than, you know, points per game. He's turning the ball over twice as frequently, more than twice as frequently as Chris Paul. But not with any appreciable increase in assists. And actually, I think he might have, win shares less than half. He's a minus by a pretty extreme degree in offensive, box score plus minus. I mean, it's not even cherry picking. They're up and down, across the board in every conceivable metric. I don't even think this is a close call. And Chris Paul, meanwhile, just, all that guy does is manage winning possessions. I had no expectation that the Thunder would be anything other than a bottom 12 offensive team. I think they're ranked like right there with Denver this season. That's amazing when you consider their personnel. Dennis Schroeder obviously has a lot to do with that. And I also credit, you know, Chris Paul for some of the evolution of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It's been a great tandem. Yeah, and again, further proof that Chris is more adaptable. He can play off the ball. He can play on the ball. He finds margins in the game to exploit. And, you know, whereas Westbrook is sort of, I think, devolving. And again, it's hard to play next to Harden. So I do kind of give him a waiver in some respects. But, I mean, he's just a guy who provides a lot of inefficient offense.
Well, and Westbrook has always been a guy, Kevin, that's, you know, it's what does he bring to the table for you? And you can stomach some of the deficiencies because of the other things that he brings to the table. The competitive spirit, the kind of random winning plays that factor into a game, whether it's a big offensive rebound, a critical steal. I mean, these are the type of things that Westbrook just innately has produced throughout his career, and that's kind of that's his makeup as a player. And those are coming fewer and far between now with the Rockets. And so stomaching the efficiency issues are a lot more difficult when you're not seeing those sort of game-changing plays happening from Russell Westbrook. And I think some of that has to do with that he's not as unfettered as he was with the Thunder. I mean, he is kind of more boxed in trying to play alongside James Harden. But, you know, on top of it, if you look at the way the Thunder have been winning, you know, they've become this incredible crunch time team, and that's because Chris Paul's one of the best crunch time players ever. You know, he leads the league in crunch time points this year, and clutch time, I should say. So
that's a good point.
Thunder offensively, I think they have like a 125 offensive rating in clutch time, which is absurd. It's the best in the NBA.
Great, yeah.
And
can I ask both of you guys?
That's because Chris Paul.
I want to ask both of you guys a question. So, and I don't want to be too much a prisoner of the moment, but I think we all thought that Oklahoma City would be a team that would shop its roster at will, just look to continue to get younger assets and future assets in exchange for some of those veterans on the team, be it Adams or Gallinari or Chris Paul or you know, Dennis Schroeder. And what do you do if you're them? You're in the seventh seed pretty solidly now. You're starting to play your best basketball. Gilgeous Alexander's is going to get better. What do you do? You know, it's a market, and Royce, you and I have talked about it a couple of weeks ago, that, you know, that's accustomed to winning. You need to be a little bit careful about an absolute total rebuild. I mean, you're well on your way, but you know, Brian and Royce, what do you do if you're the Oklahoma City Thunder over the next 5 weeks?
I think that's a decision that you talk about in early February. I think it's a little too early to, I think you push it. I also think that if you're going to do something, you're not going to harm your long-term prospects.
Right. What it means essentially, Kevin, is just the price tag that Sam Presti had on all these players a month ago, the price just went up. And so I think that there still is a price tag on Danilo Gallinari, on Dennis Schroeder, on Steven Adams, on even Chris Paul. But the leverage that he's created by his team playing well, the price is going up. So, I think the Thunder are kind of stealth buyers at the trade deadline as it stands right now. I think that they are a team that probably is willing to take on some salary in the interim. I think that they're comfortable paying the luxury tax again. They budgeted to do it. They were prepared to do it this year. And their rebuild, or what we're calling a rebuild, is kind of been pushed out into the distant future. That's when all the assets come home to roost, is 2023, 2024, 2025. So, and even further down the line. And that's, so I think that there's kind of this concept of, like, since they traded Westbrook, since they traded George, therefore they must tank. That was really never the mindset of Sam Presti in the front office. They looked at this year saying, I think we have a pretty good team. Let's see what they're capable of. And you know, they don't want to start selling off all these pieces on the roster just to kind of start a tank for the sake of it. They don't want to sell off everything for pennies on the dollar because everybody just assumed they needed to tank.
Well, that's an issue. There's a lot of the teams that we thought were going to be sellers aren't sellers at all. I will just, in putting a bow on this Westbrook Paul thing, I'll just say that the star couplings that I saw over the summer, a lot of them made sense. LeBron AD. I understand why they wanted to play together. Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. I understand why they wanted to play together in Los Angeles. I think the Kyrie Durant thing is got more facets to it, but at least in a vacuum, I could understand why they wanted to play together. I never quite understood, and I realized that it wasn't like Westbrook had 26 choices. He had limited choices, but right. I never understood why those two were so desirous to play together, because I didn't see the match, and that's been,
you know,
something
what the word is, Brian? Desperation. They're both desperate. They were both desperate.
Well,
for what they don't
have. That's a good point.
And that's kind of the type of thing that you do. You can help me. Yeah. I can help you. Let's try to go do this together.
I'm not sure they're much of a help to each other. But
I don't think that they are, but I think that's what their logic was.
Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. Thank you, Royce. Thank you, Kevin. We appreciate it. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you later this week. Mm-hmm.